You've just landed inside Launch Street, the innovation podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate and differentiate and get further faster in this crazy cluttered world. And now, innovation thought leader and your super fly host, Tamara Kleinberg.
Hello, Launch Readers. I have a fantastic conversation to bring to you today with a gentleman named Richard Banfield. He is the CEO and co-founder of Fresh Tilled Soil. It's a leading product user experience design firm based in Boston. He is also the co-author of an Amazon best-selling book called Product Leadership, How Top Product Leaders Launch Great Products and Build Successful Teams. So I wanted to talk to him for a couple reasons. One, he's an expert on building fast cycles within your product launch process. He has this whole thing about differentiating the signal from the noise. And we had this long conversation about how to teach good decision making and how critical that is in being innovative and creating success. So I think you're going to enjoy this a lot. He dropped a truth bomb at the end. So listen up. Richard, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm looking forward to digging in. So let's start with, what is your definition of product leadership? How should we be thinking about this?
I'll answer your second question first. So how you should be thinking about product leadership is the same way you think about any good leadership. So a good leader in product is going to be a good leader in any other form. So the way that you judge a good leader, say in marketing or in an executive position, you would have the same qualities associated with product managers that are in leadership positions. And that means somebody who can understand their entire operational remit, the things that they're responsible for, and also bring their team together so they can deliver value to a customer. If they are unable to deliver value to the customer and to their team, then they're not truly leading that team. What's different between product leadership and other leadership roles is that a product leader doesn't necessarily have a team to manage. You may be an individual. You may be running a division or an area of responsibility or a domain within the organization, but you may not have direct reports. So that's the difference between a manager or a product manager in this context and a product leader that has some management responsibilities but is generally leading an idea or leading the group towards delivering value.
So if you don't have a team, but you're responsible, if I hear you right, for a product or the delivery of some product or service you're bringing forward, mm-hmm. How do you think about the value you bring to the organization? Because I think oftentimes for leaders and companies, it's very easy to say, I've managed this team well, and we have met our objectives, and my team is doing amazing things. So how do you think about that value you bring, which you mentioned at the beginning as being so important? Mm.
So every company is going to be different, right? Every company is going to measure their success differently. But ideally, what you want is some way to be able to measure the success that you've delivered to your customer. So a good company to look at that does this very well is a company called Drift, run by Dave Cancel. And Drift is looking to get that feedback from the end user to see whether they have, in fact, provided that value, and therefore, are they measured against that customer's value? So they're not just looking at, did we tick things off the list? Did we ship experiences? But rather, when we actually did the things that we said we were going to do, did it have the outcome that we intended as well? So that's really important. So it's a lot of companies are measuring up until the point that they ship that thing, whatever it is, that might be an experience, it might be a feature. But what they really need to be measuring is, once they've shipped that, did it actually achieve the outcome that output was intended to create?
Well, that makes a lot of sense. When you say it like that, I'm like, of course, right.
Easier said than done.
Right, did you do what you were supposed to do? Yeah. And was someone else able to then run with it and take it to the next level?
Right. And the hard thing is actually measuring that, because that requires you to talk to the customer. And a lot of product people are scared of the customer. They don't really want to hear what they have to say because they worry they're going to get negative feedback, where in fact that negative feedback is the very thing you need in order to make the improvements or iterative changes that ultimately going to deliver the value that they want.
I'm going to jump on a tangent here because I so appreciate what you're talking about here with talking to the customers. And you know, would you say from your experience that not only is it important to get that feedback to understand, you know, what's working, what's not working, but particularly when you're trying to do something that maybe is more innovative or new to market, and if you're, you know, really leaping something disruptive to what's current, you need that customer feedback to be able to do those things. I found that in my experience, and I'd love to hear your perspective, that innovation that is created in a silo or in a bubble inside an organization tends to fail when it leaves, because by the time it has customer input, it's too late.
Well, that in theory is absolutely true. It obviously depends on what kind of business and what stage of business you're at. So for a very, very early stage business that doesn't have any customers, it's okay for the creators of that product to stand in as proxies for some of the best practices. So maybe they themselves understand the problem and they're able to start the process of creating a product or creating a solution that addresses that. But as soon as they can get something, anything, in front of their potential clientele, their customers, they should do that. So that's when we get to the point where things like prototypes are valuable. You have to start creating things that you can put in front of people, even if you are in the situation where you're so early stage, you don't really have customers.
So do you have any advice for people who are exactly what you said? They're kind of afraid to talk to the customer because, you know, God forbid you call my baby ugly. And, you know, I see this yeah. with internal people, and I see it with entrepreneurs too. And it's so funny is not the right word, but I always, you know, smile a little bit because I think, well, if you don't ask, how do you know if this is a value? But what advice do you have for them to make it, I don't know if easier is the right word, but a process that they can accept?
Well, I don't know if it's an easy process. I don't think it's ever easy to receive feedback that you don't want to hear. What I think you get better at, though, with practice, is you get less emotional about it and you become a lot more objective about that feedback. So you're thinking, wow, they are actually providing me feedback on something that I can do something about, as opposed to they're calling my baby ugly. And I think that takes practice. I think the best advice I would give anybody is it's just like any skill that requires effort. You've got to practice it. You've got to get out there and try it once, twice, three times, four times until you develop the muscle memory to be able to do it again and again. When I started doing this, I was scared shitless. I mean, I didn't want to talk to anybody. I was, you know, I didn't like presenting. I didn't like standing up in front of people. I didn't like getting on the phone. And I forced myself to go through it again and again. In fact, I went to a sales training organization that put us in these awkward situations. Like, we would have to walk into a busy office building and step into the busiest elevator going to the highest possible floor. And we would have to step in and start conversations with strangers in the elevator. And if that isn't awkward, I don't know what is.
But oh, I mean, that is like the awkward box.
Yeah, exactly. But you learn how to overcome your anxieties and realize that it really is just like any other conversation. And that when you're talking to customers, you can develop some kind of rapport with them where they are objectively giving you their insights and you're objectively receiving it, and that it's not an us against you type situation.
I just want to take a pause for listeners out there because I wrote down what you said about, is this feedback I can do something about? And I think when you're getting that constructive criticism, whatever, you know, negative, whatever you want to call it in that moment, if you can ask that question, you can get past the pain, the hurt of what they said and move to, okay, they said that this didn't work for them, but that means I can adjust this over here. Or maybe it means they're not the right target audience and I need to think about that.
Right. So the way to think about it is this a gravity problem? Because gravity is nothing you can do about. Whether you like it or not, gravity exists. If it's a gravity problem, then step away from it and address the things that you can address. So that's the way to differentiate between things that people are angry about or dissatisfied with that are general, that you can't do anything about, and things that are specific to your product or your service that you can have a direct relationship with and change.
That's great. I really like how you phrase that. So listeners out there, listen to how Richard is framing up getting feedback and owning that feedback and doing something about it. You had hinted at it a second ago, so I want to ask you about the prototypes are more persuasive than PowerPoints. You were talking about why prototypes are so important. And that's the phrase on your website of your business that really caught my attention. I stopped and went, oh, yes. So will you talk a little bit more about what you mean by that and why that is so true?
Yeah, and I'm not hating on PowerPoint specifically, because you can actually create very basic prototypes, screen flows, for example, in something like PowerPoint or Keynote or anything like that. But essentially what a prototype should be able to do is answer a question. So think about that for a second. A prototype needs to pose a question that generates an answer for you. That is the purpose of the prototype. The prototype isn't to show people how good at design you are or how good at user experience you are. It is there to solicit a response or validate a hypothesis that your customer will provide you that you can then use to make better informed decisions going forward. So one of the ways to think about a prototype is that customers are generally a really good place to go when you're trying to find out what the problems are. They're not going to provide you with the solutions. Customers do not give you the solutions. They give you the problems that need solving. You then need to take that information and go back and iterate on your prototype until it gets to the point that it actually solves the problem for them. So when they see that, they go, that is the thing that I was seeking to solve the problem. I possibly couldn't even elucidate myself.
So are you saying that in order to get real good feedback or to get people engaged, you need in some way to bring the idea to life beyond, you know, five bullets on the screen? And to your point, that could be a slide that does it in some way, or it could be duct tape and a piece of paper, but some way to bring it to life?
Yeah, the more you can solicit the right kind of feedback you need, the better. So it depends on the situation. I'll give you a good example. We had a client approach us and say that they thought that the user interface of their product wasn't sufficiently well designed in order to get the kind of conversion rates that they were seeking. And the more we spoke to their customers about what they were doing, the more the customer said, no, we actually like this user interface. We don't have a problem with this. What we really struggle with is how they actually explain their value. Their proposition is not very clear. So the prototype that we created to test that assumption is a sales script. We rewrote a bunch of sales scripts, which our designers then got on the phone and called prospective customers to test. And once those were tested, we could then say, this is the value proposition that makes the most sense. This is what gets the most traction. Here's now how we can go back to the product and adjust whatever needs to be adjusted, the copywriting, the design, etc., for that to be valid. So a prototype doesn't have to be screens in InVision or some kind of screen-based thing. It does, however, have to solicit a solution or a suggested solution to a problem that you have.
I love this. Of the prototype's purpose is to pose a question or test assumptions. That just brings it its purpose so much clearer to me. I want to kind of go back and ask about, because this is all so important if you're in product leadership or, you know, trying to bring some type of product to life. Why do you think product leadership is so relevant today in particular?
Well, it's an emerging role. It's been around for a long time. Product managers aren't brand new, but they haven't really had the amount of influence that they've had until recently. So they've been treated mostly like line managers up until the last, say, 4 or 5 years. And now they're starting to be treated like decision makers and executives, where they can actually decide where the strategy is going, where the business is headed, where the product is headed. And because of that, they're now being treated like leaders. And when you treat somebody like a leader, you get a completely different response from them than when you treat them just like, you know, somebody who's managing a particular set of responsibilities. And that's why this book was written. Myself and my co-authors wrote a book about design leadership because we were worried about this. We were thinking about it all the time. We were curious about it. We didn't understand it ourselves. So we went out there and asked those questions because it was a gap in our own knowledge about what does leadership mean for the product leader within an organization.
So you had mentioned that kind of product management or product leadership is an emerging role, and I'm definitely seeing more of it. Why do you think it's getting traction now as a role that's being recognized? Like, I'm starting to see associations with it, meetups with it in places that I never saw before.
Well, I think it's just part of the natural evolution of what's happening in technology and product creation and service creation. As the decision-making is moving out of the executive suite through the organization and into the realm of what does the customer think? So in other words, we're humanizing the process by getting the customer-centric conversation going. As that happens, the people at the forefront of that need to be included, and they need to be the ones that we go to in order to find out what the general strategy is going to be for the company, what the product strategy is going to be for the company. And the product managers and their teams, let's call them experience teams, those teams are the ones at the forefront of that decision making. They are the ones that are getting the feedback from the customers. They are the ones that understand what's working and what's not working because they are building the interfaces, they're engineering those solutions. They know what's happening. The executives have no idea what's happening. They can't possibly know what's happening because they're not talking to customers. And of course, I'm talking about slightly larger organizations. If you're a small organization and you happen to be the only person there, then yes, you should be talking to the customer. But as you get further and further into the realm of the executive, you spend less time with your customers. That's just an unfortunate part of the job. And I think that that's why the product leader, the product manager, is getting more attention because they are the ones that have the access to this information that's critical to success.
Yeah, you know, it's always been so interesting to me that frontline sales staff, customer experience professionals, product managers and leaders, like why they aren't included more at the table, given exactly what you just said, which is they're the ones on the front lines every day. And I think especially when you're trying to build new ideas and new products, you really do need the voice of the customer represented.
Yeah, yeah, you do. And I think that modern companies with any real desire to succeed are going to go and actively pursue that voice of the customer. They're not going to wait for it to happen. And I think that's part of what a product manager or product leader's role is. You need to solicit that. You need to build the systems. You need to train your team to be able to do that. And in so doing, you are going to create a more successful product.
Yeah. So as we're talking about organization, you know, team dynamics are at the core of every innovative business. So how does a modern company build and nurture high performing teams to get to that success we were just talking about?
This is going to be really easy. Cross-functional, co-located, autonomous teams. So cross-functional means teams that are representative of all the units within the organization that actually deliver that value. So engineering, design, marketing, overall product management, sometimes legal if you're in a highly regulated industry, et cetera, et cetera. So who are the people that matter when it comes to delivering value? Those people need to be on the team. Then you need those people to be co-located in some way that they are connected to each other and working with each other. Now, there are a lot of companies that are doing very well from a remote organization or a distributed organization point of view, but those people are still connected to each other on a regular basis. They're doing video conferencing and stand-ups in those types of environments. They're communicating regularly. And autonomous means that they have the power and also the maybe even the training or the coaching to make good decisions. They are not waiting for the executives to tell them what to do. They have been given a mandate or a vision to work with, and they are using that vision as a filter or a lens to make good decisions. So that way they can be left alone to do good things. They can deliver faster. They can be more agile with a small edge, and they can go out and do their job without having to wait for decisions to go up and down the ladder every time.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, you use the phrase good decisions, not right decisions. So are you saying then, I guess a little bit of a loaded question, but that, you know, it's not about if the decision worked or didn't work. It was, do they have the autonomy to make a good decision with the information, the data, the, you know, vision, strategy, et cetera, that they have? And the reason I'm asking is I think oftentimes autonomy sounds really good, but in many of the organizations that we work with, and I'm sure you see it, it's great when things work, but when something, you know, fails, doesn't work, doesn't provide the outcome, that autonomy starts to change. But that's frustrating because sometimes shit doesn't work.
Yeah. So there's two elements to that. One is, are you actually teaching people to make decisions? Mm-hmm. You have to teach them how to make decisions. Decisions are not something we learn at school. In fact, decision making is probably the very opposite of the modern Western school environment.
Yeah.
So you have to teach people how to do that. That's the first thing. And if you're not teaching them to do that, then expect more bad decisions. However, having said that, expect that some decisions won't work. It's just the nature of life. Like, not everything is going to be perfect. So you need to be working in very small cycles so that when you make a bad decision, you can correct it as well. Do not go for the big reveal. Do not work on something for 10 years and then reveal it and find out that it's a shit thing. You know, like, as you said, it's like, shit happened. Like, don't do that. Don't do the big reveal. Work in some kind of microcycle where you're working in days or at the most weeks and you can deliver stuff and deliver value to your clients or your customers and say, these are the things that we're producing. What do you think? Oh, that doesn't work. Great. No problem. We'll fix that. We've got a week to do that, or we got a couple of days to do that. So the whole time you're in this revision mentality where you're going through an ongoing cycle of changes, small decisions all the time.
Well, I think what you just said, for launch readers out there listening, really nailed it, which is about those fast cycles, so that those outcomes that work or don't work are detrimental and devastating because you haven't, to your point, waited for the big reveal. You're actually tweaking and adjusting and evolving as you go, which is a shift in, I'd say, mindset and process for a lot of organizations, big and small.
Yeah, and again, it goes very much opposite to the flow of how we were taught at school. And when we get to university and things like that, we're being told, oh, at the end of the year, we're going to do a big exam, or there's a big paper to do at the end of it. There's this big reveal mentality.
Yeah, right.
We have to break that cycle. We have to get into the conversational cycle where we say, I've got an idea. I'm going to test this today. We're going to go live with it. Oh, it didn't work. No problem. We'll fix it immediately and then we'll change it.
So how does product leadership impact innovation?
Well, it depends on the organization again. It depends how the organization sees innovation, because it's going to be different for each company. But innovation should be something that a company is doing all the time and not just in a lab somewhere. So a good example of this is something that frustrates me is I see large organizations creating a small group of people and they give them the name like Innovation Lab or something like that, and they stick them on. You know, they stick them in a really cool loft building with, you know, food
away from everybody else.
Right. And you know, and you see this a lot with enterprises. And then they expect these guys to do what Xerox PARC did, which is produce a whole bunch of really cool innovations. And that just doesn't work anymore. That's not how things matter. What that organization should be doing. I don't mind the idea that you create an innovation group. What I mind is the kind of work they do. What they should be doing is coaching and training everybody else how to think. So that means taking design thinking, taking innovation thinking to the organization. That should be their mandate. Not doing the prototyping themselves, but rather showing everybody, this is how we prototype. This is how we do a design sprint. This is how we do iterative work. Here's how to do those things. Here's how to change policy in weeks instead of months or years. That role needs to happen within all organizations. And everybody should, in small organizations, it happens almost naturally because everybody's thinking about it. But in large organizations, it should be part of the mandate of the executive to provide the resources to people to go and coach and train their company to think differently.
You know, I'm laughing a little bit as you're talking because I've worked with multiple of those teams, the disruptive innovation team, and they're, you know, they get to wear different t-shirts than everybody else. And I think one of the most frustrating things for everybody is it becomes this one-way tennis match where even if they do create really innovative ideas, when they lob it over the fence to the product team or the brand team that needs to manage it, they don't want it. They weren't a part of it. They had nothing to do with it. And they've already got three brands or products that they're managing.
Yeah.
So it becomes this very frustrating brick wall experience for everybody.
Exactly. And I think that nobody really wants that. It also feels kind of exclusive when you're doing this kind of weird little project on the side, these stealth projects. It feels like, you know, you're making an exception and that you're excluding everybody else from the possibility. And that's not where innovation happens.
Right. It's kind of like saying the rest of you aren't innovative. Those seven people are innovative.
Yeah, like, that's exactly what it is.
They get surprised, right, that there's innovation about processes and procedures doesn't come out of their teams. But
right. And it's not just like you're suggesting it. You are actually saying that. You're saying you are not good enough. You did not make it into this exclusive club.
Right. With their special t-shirts and their blue streaks in their
that's
hair.
Right.
So, what are some of the characteristics you see in successful product companies that are doing it different than maybe the poor performing companies?
They're shipping a lot of experiences. And that's a measure by which both the company and the customer can get excited about. So they're seeing a high rate of delivery of value. So getting back to what I originally said, if you're delivering value, you should be delivering it on a frequent basis. Now, every business is going to be different. So if you're a pharmaceutical company, you may only be delivering value on an annual basis. But if you're a software company like the companies that you and I work with every day, those are the kinds of companies that are going to be delivering exceptional experiences or exceptional value on a much more frequent basis. So maybe it's every other week or every other month, but it should be on the ratio of, I would say, depending on how big the company is, but you should be thinking about at least about 5 to 10 experiences a month.
I love that. So you recently co-wrote what became an Amazon best-selling book, Product Leadership, How Top Product Leaders Launch Great Products and Build Successful Teams. And we'll put a link in the show notes so people can go get it.
Great, thanks.
What are some of the big insights or ahas you gained while researching and writing the book? Is there anything that, I don't know if it surprised you, but kind of wasn't what you expected?
I think what I was most surprised at is, like I said, we had written the book almost out of curiosity. We were fascinated by this topic, and we had started these interviews with product leaders to answer our own personal questions. And what was surprising was just how many of those people who are in senior roles running big ass companies had the same questions. So, you know, you're interviewing people at Google and YouTube and Uber and all these companies that you see out there every single day and you read about every day, and you think, wow, they seem to have got it nailed. They're asking exactly the same questions. They're wondering exactly what you just asked me. What does a great team look like? How do you measure success? What does success look like? And how do we know whether we're doing the right stuff? Are we actually doing things that make a difference? What does innovation look like? All of those conversations are not conversations that just myself and my co-authors and maybe, you know, a handful of other people are having. It's a general thing that's happening across the entire industry. And I don't think there are the answers in the book aren't necessarily generic answers for everybody, but they're hopefully a start to the conversation. They're a beginning of a larger discussion where we can all get to a point where we're openly having this conversation. We're not scared of it. We're vulnerable. We're saying, look, I don't know, and it's okay. And hopefully more product managers and product leaders are getting together and having those open conversations and not just pretending that they know what they're doing.
Do you think that the you know, Googles, Apples, Teslas of the world, do you think that they are thinking about this more often than the ones that are barely keeping their head above water? I mean, as you're talking, I'm wondering, God, I wonder if part of what makes them successful is always wondering about that. And I know that a lot of us are having that conversation, but do they take it to the next level, or is that just, or is it about their implementation?
It's probably a little bit of both. I think that, I would say that it's, if you're thinking about this stuff, you're doing it better than anybody else, because at least you're having that conversation. If you're implementing it like Tesla does, then you're doing an exceptional job. So you're not just talking about it, but you're actually implementing those insights as well. I think what's really difficult for most companies is dividing the signal from the noise. So they're hearing a lot of different ways of doing things. They're hearing about, hey, we got to do agile. We got to do this. We got to do this. This is a new innovation. That's a new process. This is a new cool thing. It's very noisy, and it's not always clear what the right thing for that company is. And that then requires leadership. You need a strong leader who can paint a very, very clear vision, very clear picture for everybody and say, this is where we're headed. This is what we're going to be doing. This is why it's important. This is why it's meaningful. And here's how we're going to get there. And I think it doesn't really matter what your process is, whether you're agile or waterfall or scrum or scrum fall or scrum theater. I don't care. It doesn't really matter. What you need to be focused on is this the thing that allows us to deliver value to the customer? Because if it's not, then why are you doing that? Because that's just, you know, that's like internal masturbation. It's like, why are you doing this stuff? Nobody cares. Okay.
You know, it's so interesting that you say that. I was recently keynoting for a group of CIOs, IT, and every, you know, the agile process had just swept through. And what I was fascinated by afterwards was the amount of people that came up to me and said, I don't even know how we got into the topic because I wasn't up on the stage promoting it. And I'm neither, you know, I don't feel good or bad about it. To your point, I think it depends on the organization, how you work. But the amount of backlash I was hearing from people about how much they hated it. And I think it's exactly what you're saying is what really provides value to the customer and what really is going to work for you as an organization versus what's the trend of the day that we're all, you know, jumping on to do.
Exactly. Yeah. And I look, it's fine to be connected to what's trendy, to understand what's new, because that's how you stay innovative. That's how you stay ahead of the curve. But I think it's also very important to understand what your vision is and how you're going to deliver that value, because that's ultimately what will be the lens that determines how you organize yourself, how you structure it, and how you ultimately work every single day.
You know, one of the things that keeps popping up for me as we're having this conversation is how you've been describing product leadership and how it's really more than just I get a product from point A to point, you know, X or whatever it is. But that there are other things like design thinking and teaching others to design think and kind of spreading that innovation around. So I'm curious, if you don't have that title, or maybe someone on your team doesn't have that title, can you identify that person? Because it's more than job description, isn't it? It's also a mindset, a way of doing things in the organization. So can you figure out who those people could be if they don't have the title? And if so, how?
Yeah, it's definitely not a title specific role, that's for sure. In the work that we did in interviewing these folks, we found people with a very wide range of titles, and even working within areas of the business that I wasn't even, you know, I was very surprised to find them. Like we spent one of the guys that's in charge of product innovation at a very large insurance company used to be their chief risk officer. I mean, that kind of blows my mind. Like, here is somebody.
Yeah, that's like the opposite.
Exactly, right? But then you think about it and you think, well, who else knows a highly regulated industry better than the chief risk officer? It's this guy. He's the guy that needs to understand what we need to be doing in order to innovate. Like, where are the guardrails and how do we get around those things? So I think that it's not obvious by title. It's certainly not obvious by role. But it's probably obvious by intention. What is the intentional part of that person's role going to be in delivering value? How are they going to get you closer to the customer? Are they going to be influential in getting teams to do the things that they need to do? Because leadership, whether you like it or not, requires influence. You need to get people on board with your vision, with your strategy, with the things that you're going to be doing, and then organize that and be willing to put the time and energy and effort in every single day to get you there. So it's probably somebody who's got a large amount of empathy with the team, with the customer, who understands the vision, that can articulate it very well, that can present well, and then have the energy to actually go and do that every single day. Because it is, unfortunately, a job that comes with a lot of responsibility and not always the associated authority. At least that's the case right now. You're not necessarily going to have the same authority that the C-level has in those roles. So you may have a lot more responsibility than meets the level of authority you have. And you're going to have to just deal with that. You're just going to have to suck it up and go and do the hard work that's needed to deliver those things to your team and to the customers.
You know, Richard, what I'm really appreciating about your expertise and your insights on this interview today, on this podcast, is, you know, from my perspective, being innovative should be the foundation of your company, period, to your point, right? It's not just a product. It's not just the department in the cool loft. It should be how you run your business and the ideas and solutions your people bring to the table. And this product leadership, putting the spotlight on that and making that a focus and an intention inside your organization is one of the keys to getting there.
Yeah.
To making sure that happens.
Yeah, it is one of them. I would be remiss if I said that it's the only thing. It's not, right?
Always many.
Right. You've got to have a full plate. You've got to look at everything across the organization. And that's what the most mature organizations are doing. They're seeing all aspects of the business be part of innovation. So even that call center or the customer service rep, that person is part of innovation because they are getting feedback from the customer. How do you find out how to get those cold face incidents back into your product team so that they can do something about them? And that's why, you know, companies like Pluralsight, for example, who Nate Walkinshaw is the chief experience officer of, they've got customer support people on their teams because those customer support people see things that everybody else can't possibly see. They see what goes wrong. They see that the pain that the customer is feeling, and they're able to filter that back into the organization for either improvements or repairs.
So I can't even believe we're getting close to the end. I feel like we need to continue this conversation because I have so many questions for you. But for now, what's one big takeaway or piece of advice, whether that's from your book or from your experience working with the clients, that the Launch Street listeners can implement right now?
What stage of business are they in? Are they in early stage businesses?
You know, we have a mix. Here's the common theme among them is they're innovators and they're looking to shake things up. And some of those are entrepreneurs within large organizations and some of them are entrepreneurs.
I would say the best piece of advice is go and talk to your customers, but go and talk to them with what we discussed earlier in mind. They are not there to give you solutions. Customers do not give you solutions and that's not their job either. Go and talk to them to understand the problems that they have, understand their pains, spend time with them. Here's a good example or maybe an analog. Remember in the old days, the doctor would make a house call. The doctor would come to you and they would see what environment that you were in. And they might say, wow, you know, it looks like you might be suffering from asthma because you have 25 cats. You are the crazy cat lady. And you have 25 cats, and that is probably contributing to your lung is feeling bad. The current situation is you leave that environment, you leave all of those environmental stuff, you go to the doctor's offices, which is the sterile environment, and you say, you know, I'm suffering from this malady or that malady, and the doctor has no environmental context. So they say, oh, well, you know, you just remind me of somebody else I saw 20 minutes ago. Here's a drug that I'm going to treat you with. That's exactly how product teams are working right now. They're asking customers to come into their offices, or they're doing interviews over the phone. Go and see them. If you're working on an innovation around travel, go and travel with them. Ask them if you can ride along to the airport with them. Watch them checking in at the airport. Watch them struggle with those big suitcases and faltering with that app that's supposed to work that checks them in or that gets them the boarding pass. All of those things are things you cannot possibly see when you are on the phone or you're interviewing them in your office. You have to go to where they are and observe the context so that you understand why that pain is meaningful to them.
And don't you find too, that first of all, that analogy with the doctor was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. Like it makes me sad now that we go to doctor's offices because they're missing 90% of the context.
Yeah.
And we're not liars as people. We just put our best foot forward. And it just, what you were saying reminds me of, we always do ethnographies when we do innovation work. And, mm-hmm. you know, we go into people's lives. And a couple of years ago, we were doing one on a healthier breakfast. And we recruited people on the phone who said, I live a healthy lifestyle. Now, that's a very subjective word. Mm-hmm. And I will never forget one of the houses we went to where she sat us down and talked about how healthy she was. And then we went to the kitchen with her for her to make breakfast. And there was a deep fryer on the counter. Mm-hmm. There was like full sugar Gatorade in the fridge, and she was putting, I can't even count the number of teaspoons on her Cheerios. Yeah. But in her mind, she was healthy. But if I had taken her word for it over the phone or even in a focus group, I would have never really understood what she meant by healthy. So what you're saying is so important, of going out and putting yourself in their shoes and living their life and really understanding. Because I don't think our customers are liars. I just think that we don't even know what to share.
No.
And we put our best foot forward. Of course, yeah. I'm healthy. That 10, you know, teaspoons of sugar is better than the 20 I used to use. So
exactly. <you know? laughs> Yeah, no, I mean, that's why. And it's also more fun. You know, it's way more fun getting out of the building and going talking to these people. You know, recently we did a big project for an organization that delivers a software product that helps manage horses. So if you've got a horse and you've got veterinary records and you're actually using that horse to train young kids to ride, you've got to invoice those people. There's a whole lot of paperwork and stuff that needs to be managed. Well, what does that look like? You know, go to the farm, put on your Wellingtons, walk through the manure, experience that. It'll be the best day you ever had. I guarantee you.
You're so right. That is my favorite part of the work. And it's about, you meet people who you would never interact with on a daily basis, which I think just brings more perspective to all of your work too.
Exactly.
At the end of the day.
Context is everything.
Yeah. Although I've never worked with horses, people with horses, that would be fascinating.
Not too late. Not too late.
So what's the kind of a last, any other kind of last piece of advice when we start to think about this product leadership or how to foster or create that role, whether we're big or small? I think, you know, it's an important thing to think about. What are your, you know, last words for them in that realm?
You know, obviously, I know this is probably a cliche, but the idea of being a lifelong learner and staying connected to what's happening and what's new and what's evolving, I think that's actually part of your job. You know, people say to me, oh, I don't have time to read, or I don't have time to listen to podcasts, or I don't have time to go to a conference. That's your job. Your job is to make time to do that stuff. You need to be reading 30 books a year. You need to be going to a couple of conferences. And don't go to the big, shitty conferences. Go to the small ones where you can actually have a conversation with somebody, where you can get some intimacy and some understanding around a topic, and that you're not just one of, you know, 20,000 people stuck in a huge, big hall in Vegas. You know, go and have conversations with people. Introduce yourself. Tell them what you're doing. Be a little bit vulnerable. listen to podcasts, join a Slack group. That's your job. Your job is to stay connected, because people and the innovative others that are surrounding us, that's where those great ideas, that's where the innovations come from. It's not from your mind. You know, you can't just sit there quietly in your room every day hoping that you're going to have a light bulb go off. It's just never going to happen.
I feel like you just dropped a truth bomb. It's fantastic. So where can people go to get your book, connect with you? And we'll, like I said, we'll put all the links in the show notes. So if you're driving, you don't have to pull over and write it down. But where should people go?
Book's available on Amazon. It's called Product Leadership. The subtitle is probably a little bit more descriptive: how top product managers launch awesome products and build successful teams. And you can reach me on Twitter. I'm R.M. Banfield. It's Richard Michael Banfield, R.M. Banfield. Or Fresh Tilled Soil is my company, and that's also a Twitter handle that I follow. And I'm not on Facebook because it's overwhelming. but you know, you can also troll me on Instagram. So yeah.
Excellent. So my last question for you is, what's one thing people would be surprised to learn about you? A hobby, an experience, a passion?
They're probably not that surprised because I have a different accent, but I grew up in South Africa. And while I was growing up in Africa, one of the things that I did was I became a diving instructor on a small group of islands, an archipelago of islands called the Islamic Republic of the Comores, which is kind of middle of nowhere in the Indian Ocean. And I lived there for a year doing pretty much the coolest job in the world, which is diving every day and managing the water sports.
How did you leave?
Yeah, well, I hate to tell you this, but eventually even that gets a little, you know, scary, yeah, and overwhelming. Like, yeah, I started to smell like a wetsuit and...
I was saying, for anybody.
Yeah, starting to have like the minor side effects of decompression sickness from diving every day. So I decided, well, maybe a change of scenery, and I went back and I studied biology. So yeah, complete change of scenery.
You know what I love about that, though? First of all, I would not have expected that, but also I love that, you know, it's those type of crazy experiences that actually help us gain perspective in whatever it is we end up doing next. It doesn't feel like it in the moment. We don't know.
Yeah.
But later, it actually helps us.
Yeah. You know, in fact, one of the books that I would love to write is something around this idea of turning your life upside down. And instead of waiting until you're old to retire, actually do all the cool things when you're young. And
I mean, why not?
And do like a reverse retirement. So spend the first 10 years just doing all the insane things and then get a job when you're like 30.
Right. Oh my God, it's great. You know, it's so funny because you're so right. We always talk, people talk about the bucket list, and I refuse to talk about the bucket list because I'm not going to wait until I'm close to death to start doing the stuff I want to do. But you're absolutely right. You can always get a job, but you can't always travel the world.
Yeah. And you can get the coolest little jobs when you're traveling anyway. So, you know, that's good money. It's cash in your pocket, and this, you know, maybe not even taxes. Who knows?
And that's when you don't care when you're sharing a house with 10 other people.
No, it
when you don't care.
Yeah. When you smell like a wetsuit, it's a good time.
Oh my God. Well, Richard, this was a fantastic conversation. So thank you for the great insight and sharing your experience with us.
You're welcome. Looking forward to it again.
Thanks for hanging out with us inside Launch Street. When you're ready to take your game to the next level, join the thousands of others that are upping their innovation edge on GoToLaunchStreet.com, the top online education resource and community platform for innovators looking to use innovation to get measurable results. GoToLaunchStreet.com.